And you know, not even half the population are ever going to give birth. 100% of the population are going to die. So it makes no sense to me that it's that way around. You know, like you say, it's
I just want to see the same things you can see, understand the meaning on a new degree.
In this episode, I sit down to interview Emma from Dying to Help. And Emma and I have kind of known each other peripherally, follow each other on social media. You know, we're both kind of in the same circles, but it was wonderful to sit down and chat with her. And she is just so bubbly and interesting and has so many different things going on. 100% like the best kind of person to show that being death positive, talking about death education, being a celebrant, being a doula, all of these things, doesn't make you a depressed human being. It makes you cherish life, and you can see how like bubbly and excited she is about all the things that she has going on. So this was a great conversation. The interviews that I have done, I don't know, maybe I'm a bad interviewer. I do know how to interview, but I like being able to just jump into a conversation with somebody without a whole lot of prep work. This to me is more about just talking and seeing where the conversation goes rather than having bullet points to hit. But I still think we got some pretty interesting things in there. So, you know, I hope you enjoyed this episode. I know it's different than the conversations that have, you know, been published up to this point, but it's a good thing to listen to other experienced death workers talk about these things as well. I think this is another aspect of what I want to do with Talking with Mortals, is be able to demonstrate what everyday death workers in all sorts of different branches of what that means are doing, and give you a flavor of what it's like to do this work and make it not so scary, because we are just people. So enjoy, do all of the things, like, follow, subscribe, share, send carrier pigeons, train slugs to send little coins to help support. I'm being weird now. Okay, enjoy.
Maybe that could happen when you're next to me. I just want to see the same things you can see.
Thank you so much. Today I have Emma joining me. Emma and I are connected because we are both members of End of Life Doula UK.
Yeah.
But you do so much more than that. So, you know, please feel free to introduce yourself, what it is that you do, and we can go from there.
Amazing. Yeah. So I run a community interest company called Dying to Help. So that's a not-for-profit or a social enterprise. And I set up Dying to Help. Originally, I was a funeral celebrant, independent funeral celebrant, and I kind of ran it under that banner. Then I realized I wanted to do a bit more than that. So I trained in end-of-life planning, and then eventually did my foundation course with End of Life Doula UK, or with Living Well, Dying Well, and then joined End of Life Doula UK. I'm doing my diploma at the moment. And I also do lots of death education events. So I run an online monthly death book club. I pop up at various places where anywhere that'll have me talking about death and dying, I will be there.
Fair enough. Yeah, same. Absolutely. yeah, so you're kind of like the full package then. Do you tend to be a celebrant to people that you are a doula for, or is that kind of separate? How does that work?
Yeah, so I'll be anybody's celebrant. So far my doula work, it really started, I was also working as a chaplain in a care home up in Northumberland, and I did that for about 6 years. And so my kind of hands-on doula experience were before I did any of the official doula training, so to speak. And so that was the work that I did was doula work with residents who were nearing end of life. And then I would do vigil work sitting with them. And then often I would get the opportunity to lead their funeral as well. And for me, that whole package is wonderful because I get the time to spend getting to know a person. I get to kind of minister to them and their family and kind of be with through that journey. And then when I get to deliver a funeral ceremony, when I'm writing it, it's like writing it for a friend. It's someone that I've known and journeyed with. So most of my doula experience has been in that capacity. I have done a little bit of doula work kind of since I've come out of that role, and have done a couple of funerals for people that I've done kind of light, what I would call light touch doula work with. So yeah, but most of it would be people I haven't worked with on the doula side of things.
Right. Wow. Okay. Yeah, I think most people, if they've had an experience of death, of a funeral, or not so much celebrants, I think that's a little bit different, because celebrants take the time to get to know the family and the people. But I've had the experience of going to a funeral and the minister mispronounced the person's name throughout the entire service. And if, you know, if anything's going to take you out of saying goodbye in any sort of like sacred spiritual way, then that definitely will. So I can imagine, just, you know, having worked with clients, being able to take that relationship all the way through to the end and being able to honor them in that way, is, it must be amazing.
Absolutely. It is. Although I will confess, I have done exactly the thing that you have said, and it only happened to me once, and it was a resident from the care home, and I had known her for 2 years. I didn't mispronounce her name. Her son, who I had known for 2 years, his name was Neil, but it was spelled Niall. And even though I knew his name was Neil, because it was written as Niall in my script for the whole funeral, I called him Niall. He thought it was hilarious. And his mum would have thought it was hilarious as well. And I was just like, I can't believe I've done that. But no, you're right. It's the one thing that I say when I go and meet families, with the funeral work, I'll say, I'm going to ask you so many questions about your person who's died. And you might go, why are you asking those things? And I'm like, because I want to feel like I know the person. The greatest compliment I get as a celebrant is when someone comes out of the funeral and they'll go, I didn't know you knew them. And I'm like, I didn't. But I work really hard to make it sound like I did, because I've been to so many rubbish funerals. I think many of us have. And I want to kind of try and eradicate, you know, that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to be fair, we all are human. And unfortunately, it is one of those situations where you get one shot, don't you? There's one funeral, yeah. You know, there's really not a lot you can do. So, you know, stuff happens.
It does. And it is as well how you style it out as well, you know, but it is about, like you say, the more you know someone, the better a job you can do.
Yeah. It's interesting to me how many people that I speak to that come to doing doula work specifically, that when you go through the training, you realize, oh, I've been doing this for a while now, actually, or there's so many elements of it that I have been doing just with my family or community. And I really enjoy those people, because I've come at it from a different point of view. It's not something that I've ever had the opportunity to do. So it's interesting to learn of people that are kind of coming already from that community-based, you know, pathway.
I think that many more of us have the experience to draw from than maybe we think we do. I also think that the kind of the modern death machine and industry has taken a lot of that away. I used to call myself a progressive death worker until I realized that I'm not progressive at all. I'm regressive. I'm going back to the ways that things were, you know, where you would have the person would die at home. They would be cared for by their family and by the woman in the village who would know what to do. And that's what I'm advocating for, kind of going back. Funeral professionals and the medical professionals we have, absolutely brilliant. But we don't have to fully rely on them. And they've kind of robbed us from some of that touch of death ourselves. And just as a human being, my kind of just experiencing being with someone as they die and experiencing caring for a body after someone has died, it is a deeply, richly human experience that I think everybody should have the opportunity to see and be part of. And I think that would take away an awful lot of fear you know, that we have about the unknown and about death, because it's only unknown because we don't get to see it. But actually, it's generally normal, natural, a process. And if people can just get that experience, they'd see it differently.
Yeah, I agree completely. And one of my biggest pet peeves is this whole, like, calling eco burials or natural burial grounds like new. No, that's not new. That's the way that we've kind of always done it. The new is the casket.
Exactly, we always did.
It's not at all new. New is like, you know, aquamation or, you know, something like that. That's different. But yeah, I agree completely. I think it does people a disservice to act as though death is something that is impossible for you to be with, to work through, to confront. And I think it just creates this perpetual like fear of, oh, I can't do that. That's too scary. It's too much.
Yeah.
It, of course, it is probably one of the most difficult things we'll ever go through, but I don't think you can fully go through it without confronting it or being with it fully.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. Yeah, it's just recognizing that our bodies were made to die, and that it is natural and normal, and the body knows what it's doing. And often we just need to accompany that. You know, actually something I read just this morning was talking about how the interventions that we have at end of life are often more to make those of us left behind feel more comfortable. And, you know, because we're witnessing a death can be overwhelming for us if we don't know what to expect. So we want interventions for our person. But actually, if we just allow the body to do its thing, we might need less interventions than we think. I guess that's, you know, it would very much depend, you know, on the person who was dying and how their dying process was going and how comfortable they were with the whole idea of how this is being handled. But I think sometimes we need to kind of shift our focus from this is horrifying and realize that actually, you know, it's normal. What's horrifying for us who are not dying, who are not that person who's dying, is that we're going to be left without that person. It's the grief and the loss and the bereavement. But the actual death bit isn't that bad. Or doesn't have to be that bad.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there's a lot of fear that just comes from ignorance, you know, just simply not knowing and understanding what that process looks like or never having been with it. Clearly, like, some people have harder deaths than others.
Yes.
You know, the terminal agitation is one that I think even if you're prepared for and you've seen it, it's still difficult to sit with. I agree. I think for me personally, it's been a major learning curve, because all of my experience with death has been sudden and unexpected. So I haven't had, I kind of call it the luxury, but it's really not in many ways. The ability to see death coming in that way and be able to prepare. So that has been for me a huge part of my learning as a doula, and what that looks like.
I think, you know, what you said about kind of the luxury, both sides have merit, you know. So someone dying quickly and suddenly and not going through a prolonged period of what we would see as suffering and might well be suffering, well, that's a blessing for that person. Surely they didn't have to suffer, but it's a shock for them, for us, as they're wrenched from us so suddenly. And the other side, the time that we get to prepare, but someone knowing that they're dying and maybe having fear and maybe having pain and maybe having distress about that. So, but that's where I think with those deaths, you know, those ones that are a bit more drawn out, anything that isn't a sudden death, bring a doula into that space, even if it's just to ask the doula some questions, you know, even if it's, you're not going to engage the doula for full services, but you just want to know, what's going to happen next. So back end of last year, I get a text message off an old family friend, and I knew that her dad had been unwell for a number of years. And she just messaged and said, you know, dad's just come home from hospital on end of life care. The palliative care team are coming. What happens now? And I said, right, okay, let's talk about this. How much do you want to know in this space? You know, I will tell you things and you tell me if that's enough, or you want to know a little bit more. And it was her biggest question and worry was for, like, she says, well, we're going to have carers come in a couple of times a day, or, you know, three or four times a day. But my mum's worried, what if dad dies in between that time? And to be able to explain to her that, you know, her dad had, there was a well-known trajectory for this illness. He was on palliative care. He was at home. If the carers were there and they were coming back in 2 or 3 hours, it's highly unlikely that he's going to be fine in that visit and die suddenly in between. It's like, you will see the pattern, and the carers and the palliative care team will tell you. And, you know, and each day I was just checking in and I was like, how's his breathing? How's his circulation? You know, is he communicating? And we were able to just map that normal death out. And she was like, to make sure that the biggest gift was knowing that she didn't have to worry that all of a sudden dad was going to drop down dead. They had this, you know, and I was like, I can't promise that that's not going to happen. I don't know that he's not going to have a massive heart attack or something, but the normal natural process in this situation looks like this. And that, she said, was brilliant for her, just to kind of go, okay, I get it.
Yeah, no, what a wonderful thing to be able to give to your friend too. Like, just being able to help out in that way. As you were saying that, it reminds me, so I'm not a mother, I don't have children, but I am so aware of the connection between like birth doulas and death doulas. And I always think about how horrific childbirth would be if nobody talked about it, if nobody warned you of like, okay, well, this is what's going to happen and here are the next steps. And we're so educated, and even then I don't think we're entirely that educated until you get into the thick of it, of the stages of birth and the stages of, you know, well, first this will happen and then that. No wonder we're scared of death, because we don't have that literacy.
Exactly. And you know, not even half the population are ever going to give birth. 100% of the population are going to die. So it makes no sense to me that it's that way around. You know, like you say, it's the analogy I use is we're afraid of death because we don't see it. It's like the bogeyman that's under the bed when the light's off and you're in bed on a nighttime. When you turn the light on, that bogeyman, that monster, is just a pile of dirty laundry. It's nothing to be scared of when the light's on. Death literacy, talking about death, having just these conversations turns the light on and it makes you go, okay, I can see a bit more of that. It still looks like a scary monster, but I can see that it's just socks and pants. But it's in the shape of a scary monster, you know, and we can slowly start to bring more of the socks and pants into the light. and it doesn't have to be as scary.
Yeah, I really like that. I think that's the title of this episode. 100%. Yeah. I mean, there's so many different things that you encounter in life that are existentially terrifying, but we prepare for them and we have systems around that. And I think that's what religion and spirituality used to offer, is a support system and a literacy with other people who had the same belief system. But now that that's not as common, then we're left floundering to come up with our own. And who knows what that's going to look like for each individual, but then we don't have that shared awareness either.
Yeah, and I absolutely agree. I do think, though, so I am also an ordained minister in the Free Methodist Church, and I have a Christian faith, but the church is a bit rubbish about talking about death. We are great at talking about what happens after and encouraging people with that, but getting alongside someone who's actually, you know, facing the reality of the death bit, still not so great. So yeah, the existential stuff, the what happens beyond. And even then, the church in general can not be great at it. I think that tapping into spirituality in its widest sense, we all have spirituality regardless of whether we have faith or anything like that. Tapping into that, into the what makes me tick, how do I interact with people, how do I interact with the world around me, how do I interact with something beyond, tapping into those parts of us, and really getting to know ourselves in that space, I think can be a really good starting point as well for exploring some of these conversations. Because if you've never thought about anything beyond, you might never even thought about the ways you interact with the world around you. You might only ever have thought about yourself and how you interact with other people. Those are kind of the basics that you need in order to get through life. But if you've not started to think about bigger questions, then the idea of death or whatever happens beyond it, that's going to be terrifying. It's going to be like asking, you know, a four-year-old to do physics. Nobody should ever have to do physics, but do you know what I mean? It's like, it's just too big a leap. So it's about kind of starting small and this is like when I'm having conversations with people, sometimes the idea of a death conversation is too big. So we might just talk about what's your favorite music? What do you like? You know, what are some of your favorite places? And then we can weave those things into why do they make you feel good? What is it about them that connects with you in a certain way? We then might take that down to, do you think that maybe towards the end of your life, if you were in bed and not able to get up and go to the beach, which is your favourite place, would it be nice if we brought the sounds and sights and smells of the beach into your room? Yeah, great. Then we can do that. And it's about taking that journey as slowly as it needs to be taken, which is why we should all be having these conversations from a really early age, you know, as early as possible, especially, you know, at least as soon as we hit adult life. Even in teens, we can, you know, approach some of these conversations in a, in the right way, and just kind of figure out what makes me tick, therefore what's going to bring me comfort, and therefore where do I think I might want to be and where might my brain be taking me and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, you just stole the question that I was going to ask you. It was, as you were speaking, I was thinking, what age do you think we should be speaking about this? But like, yeah, I agree. I think it's something that is worthy of being engaged in from a very early age, as early as, you know, if you're starting to ask those questions, then you are age appropriate for whatever comes up.
Yes.
And it needs the time to think about and to change and to morph as you grow.
Absolutely. And I'm a huge advocate for children at funerals, particularly if it's not the closest relative. So, you know, if the very first funeral you ever go to is a parent or a grandparent you were very close to, that's going to hit really hard. But if you get to go to Great Uncle Fred's funeral when you're six, which I didn't get to go to when I was six, and I'm not bitter about it at all, then, you know, that's my earliest memory of death, is knowing that my Great Uncle Fred had died and me saying, when's the funeral, and being told, you don't need to worry about that. That made no sense in my head because I knew there were funerals when people died. So I'm an advocate for children at funerals, but I'm also an advocate for, in the UK, the curriculum's changing, isn't it? And they're bringing in bereavement and grief training into schools from an early age, age appropriate. That's brilliant. I'm working on a bit of a project that I'm hopefully going to roll out at some point. I've got a million projects, but with a local primary school, to talk about death and dying in age-appropriate ways and to take them through a mock funeral. This is what happens at a funeral. This is what happens if you go to the crematorium and the curtains close. Granddad doesn't suddenly burst into flames, because I've had adults ask me that question. When I say, do you want the curtains to close? They'll say, well, I don't want to see the flames. no flames behind that curtain, you know, it's not fire retardant enough. That's definitely in another room. But there's no such thing as a stupid question. And adults feel like they're asking stupid questions because they feel like they should know. So let's get the kids asking these questions. And it's just about making it as normal as possible. So you find a dead bird in the garden. What do you do? How do you use that? My friend's got cats and it's constantly catching voles. So they are constantly having little burials in their garden. And this is teaching the kids kind of, this is normal, this is natural, this is life and this is death, you know, and it just normalizes stuff.
Yeah. I'm imagining like a little mini cemetery of just nothing but little vole graves, like little headstones. So I come from a very rural area in America where farming, like everybody was a farmer, everybody hunted. Again, it's also one of those almost like country living, city living comparisons that when you grow in the country, then you see dead animals and things get hit on the road. And, you know, it's just a part of life that I think you learn from a very, very early age. Have you ever had any interesting like child involvement in a funeral or a celebration of life or anything?
I've had kids as young as 4 in a funeral. And in that one in particular, it was the little boy's mum that had died. And so I just asked that if I could meet with the little boy beforehand. And I told him exactly what was going to happen in the service. And we just talked through about the fact that the coffin was going to come in and mum's body was going to be in that coffin, and it was going to go up onto a platform and we were going to say some things about mum, we were going to listen to some music, and then at some point there was going to be curtains that were going to close around mum's coffin, and it was, you know, it's just like saying goodnight at that point. And I says, and you don't have to sit still and you don't have to be quiet. And this is what's happening. But this, you know, and I kind of checked in with the family beforehand and that kid was ace through that. With regards involvement, the most beautiful experience, and this was kind of what got me started in this world of death work. So my friend had 5 children, and she had 8-year-old twins, and one of the twins had been unwell for a while. And we knew he was coming to the end of his life, Daniel. And when Daniel died, they asked me to do Daniel's eulogy. I don't have children either. I have a heck of a lot of surrogate children, and those kids were some of my kids. So I did Daniel's eulogy, and it was in a small rural church in Lancashire. Just family. Now they're from a massive family. So this small church was packed. And then he was getting buried in that churchyard. And then they were having a big celebration service in a bigger church in the city. So we did the eulogy, did the service, went to the graveside. Daniel was buried, and everyone goes off for refreshments in the hall and stuff. And I just noticed Daniel's brother, Joel, walking back over to the grave where the guy is just manually backfilling the grave. And I just like hung back just a little bit, but I thought, I'm just going to keep an eye. Don't want to worry any of the other adults. And Joel just went up to the gravedigger and went, can I do that? And the gravedigger amazingly just handed him the shovel, and Joel just started shoveling the soil onto Daniel's coffin, going, bye-bye, Daniel. Bye-bye, Daniel. Joel knew what he needed. And I use their names because I've got permission, and I tell this story a lot because it was the most beautiful thing I have ever seen from a human being who had not yet been told what was supposed to happen at a funeral and what you weren't supposed to do. But he knew he needed to put that soil in his brother's grave. So he just did it. So he's like in his early 20s now. And I saw them a couple of months ago, and I was telling him this story. He has no recollection of it. It clearly wasn't that significant to him. Or maybe it was at the time, but massively significant for me. That is just huge. Absolutely huge. but allowing them to, the other thing I do if I'm meeting a family and there's children, maybe it's grandchildren or whatever, I always tell families that I'm an advocate for children in funerals and that they don't have to sit still and be quiet. I also tell them that they know their children best. And if their children are not going to come to the funeral, can they draw a picture or write a letter to go with the coffin so that they feel they've had the opportunity to take part, or at least give me their memories that they want seeing. But I just want kids to know that this really important, significant ceremony and ritual includes you. Even if you can't be there, even if you maybe you're given the choice and you don't want to be there, but it includes you because you're a part of that person's life and they were really important to you. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, that is absolutely beautiful. And I think you touched on something that, whether it's children or adults or whomever, knowing what you can do is so, nobody tells you all the options that are available to you as somebody who has just lost a person. And one of the things that comes to mind is like spending time with the body after they've died. People don't realize that you can do that. And I think it's such a critical part of the death process to understand and start to like accept what's happened. God, what a beautiful story. I totally understand why you tell that story, because it's just, I can see that. And even if he doesn't remember it, I'm sure it did something internally.
Yeah.
But yeah, just, I think, you know, you are a death educator, so you understand how much of the work is just getting people to know what is possible.
Yeah. So I always say we don't know what we don't know. So we don't know to ask questions about it. So you meet me in the pub, and I'm going to tell you something about death that you didn't know. You know, I'm just going to drop these things in. You know, and if I'll go out with my mom sometimes. We were on holiday together in Spain a couple of years ago. And I've got a tattoo. I've got a few tattoos, but I've got a tattoo here that says, "For death is not the end." And I'm sat in a bar on the beach in Spain, and this couple beside said, "Oh, what does your tattoo say?" So I tell them, and then I launch into why I've got it and what I do. And my mom's going, Emma. And I'm like, "Mom, they asked." You know, and I'm like, I'm not going to stop because they, but you know, it's about reading the space and reading the room and reading the people. But yeah, there's not a day go by when I don't tell somebody something, because you need to know. And what I found is I started doing funerals 8 years ago, but I've been in this death care world for, you know, maybe 12, 15 years, kind of subtly in the background. What I found is now I'm the one, I'll wake up to a random WhatsApp from someone saying, like, so when the Queen died, got a message off a friend, "Has she been embalmed?" And I was like, so I just replied going, "Well, I wasn't there. But the fact that she's in a lead lined casket, I expect she's probably been embalmed as well," you know. Or I'll just get texts with just a song, and then they'll just put, "For my funeral." Or, you know, just you get these questions, you know, and then somebody else was like, "Will such and such just be bones now?" You know, and it's like, ask the questions. But when people know that you're happy to answer the questions, it's like, yeah, then they start asking, and they'll do it on the sly. You know, they won't necessarily start asking when there's other people around, but they'll drop you that message. "I really want to know what happens when. I really want to know, do I have to do this?" And I'm like, great, I'll tell you. But people just need to know who to ask. That's why I always talk about it.
Yeah. I think it's a curse of the trade, honestly. It's just, you become that person. And I'm so happy to be that person. Yes.
Yeah, it's a blessing. It's an absolute blessing. I talk about it like forever and ever and ever.
Yeah. My go-to little tidbit, I need to make sure that I'm saying this right, is that in England, I don't think it's across the whole UK, but in England at least, that you can bury up to 3 or 4 people on your property. Yeah.
I think it's 2. So, I think 2, it's 2.
Okay.
I'm not sure. But yeah, because I think after 2, it becomes a burial ground and you have to register it as such. So you can still bury more, but you have to register it as a burial ground at that point. But yeah, I always tell people, did you know you can be buried in your back garden if you've got, if you own the land? My favorite one is about burial at sea, because in England, there are three places that are permanently licensed for burial at sea. Two of them are off the south coast, and one of them's in Tynemouth, which is like just over the river from me. And so many people here don't know. You know, I live on the coast. We've got a lot of families who have like maritime history, you know, and I'm like, can you imagine if your granddad died and you had his funeral and you cremated him or whatever, or you buried him in the local cemetery and you found out 2 weeks later that he could have been like literally tipped off the back of a boat in the North Sea? Like, how gutted would you be to know that that was an option? If you then go, granddad would have loved that. You need to know these things beforehand, you know, and to know it's on your doorstep. So that's my kind of tidbit. But yeah, burial grounds in your garden and off the boat in the North Sea.
yeah. There's always something like, and I think that also adds to, it adds to the trauma. I say that with like a very, like a small T. Because the end of life, we build up to be this massive moment, and you're still just living. So things can go wrong and things, you know, might not go to plan, but as long as you have as much information as you can in order to do that well for the person and for the family, then I think you're removing a lot of that possible trauma that comes from regret afterwards. And that it's always so unfortunate when you meet people like that, like you just said, that they'll find out like, oh, I didn't have to do it that way, or I could have done this, that would have been nice. And you can't rewrite history, unfortunately. So
no, and I always tell people, you know, we do the best that we can with the information that we've got at the time. And the other thing is, you know, if you've done dad's funeral, you know, you've organized all of this, or you know, or support a dad at the end of his life, and that, and then you're, you know, you're making decisions, whatever decisions you're making are the right ones at that point, because it's the only decision that you can make, so it's the right decision, you know, particularly if someone's not left any instructions and not had the conversation. When I was working in the care home, it was one of the conversations I had with every resident was their kind of their final wishes. What did they want to happen? And a lot of it was around the funeral. And so many of them would say, I'll let my daughter sort that out. So I would say, I call everyone Betty. I'd say, Betty, that's lovely that you're happy for your daughter to do whatever she wants. But when you die, I think your daughter's going to be really sad. And she's going to have all this other sad admin to do, all the sad admin that has to happen when you die. What if we just gave her some pointers? What if we put down some favourite music choices, whether you think you'd prefer to be buried or cremated? And, you know, and obviously being me, I tell them about all the other options as well, but they would generally, you know, these are of a generation who it was burial or cremation. And we'll just put some guidance down, and then we can put at the bottom, Betty says she's really happy for our daughter to ignore all of this and do whatever she wants. But if she needs some guidance, these are some of the things Betty has said. Not a single resident said no when I said that to them. They were like, oh, yeah, let's do that. You know, and it's just like just capturing bits of information, because, you know what it's like when you're bereaved and your brain is doing its grief thing and it's gone into sludge, and you've got all of the practical things that have to be organized and paid for and sorted. Thinking about mom's favorite song and what she might want to be wearing, those things can just fall out of your brain. You might not remember those things, but actually those are the personal touches that you will beat yourself up about later, even though we tell you not to, you know, so it's like, think about those things and write them down and make sure your family know where that document is and update it, for goodness sake. Because at the minute, my funeral plan says I want Dancing by Kylie Minogue to be played at my funeral. And I'm really hoping that I live long enough that I really don't want Dancing by Kylie Minogue at my funeral, that I've kind of chosen something else by then. So update your plans, you know, every year, or just at least sign and date it to say it's still relevant.
Yeah, that's definitely that's key, because I think mine if I had done it when I first knew about advanced care planning, I always joke that it would have been something from like Green Day. And it's like, love Green Day still, not appropriate right now for who I am right now. Yeah.
And that's the key, what you've just said there, not appropriate for who you are right now. So that's the other thing I'll get from families. They'll go, oh, we thought about having this song, but it's not appropriate. And I'm like, who gets to say it's not appropriate? Absolutely. So I did a funeral on Christmas Eve for a lady. And when I went to meet her daughter, the music going in was the Birdie song. And I was like, are you sure? And she was like, yes. She always played it and the grandkids loved it. And so I just went, do you want me to do the Birdie dance going in? And she was like, will you? I was like, yeah. And that was, you know, and that was right. So there's nothing that's not appropriate. The only caveat to that, I would say, is depending on the venue you're in, you know. So if you're in a church, you're probably not going to, they're not going to like you playing Smack My Bitch Up by The Prodigy. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it's just, you know, I mean, there's a lot worse that they probably wouldn't want you to play as well. But it's just thinking context. But yeah, I'm like, do whatever is right. I've done two funerals dressed as Elvis because that was right for the person. Wow. And I'm like, yeah, that's not a problem. I have two red lines that I don't cross when it comes to funerals. And I tell everyone, you can have anything you want. I can do anything you want as long as it doesn't cross these two red lines. So I am a Christian and I am an ordained minister and I won't do prayers and rituals from another religion. But I'll get someone in to do that bit if that's what you want. Not a problem. And secondly, I'm a Sunderland supporter, so I won't wear any Newcastle shirt. And that's it. That's my two red lines. So, and generally, because I work across the Northeast, it's brilliant because that gets that one, the football one, gets a reaction either, oh, brilliant, you're on our side, or, oh, my goodness, who have we picked? And I'm like, I can't be perfect, you know. But it just, it's the banter, and that cuts the tension in the family consultation. And, yeah, and it's like, I've worn other football shirts before, and I've done a whole bunch of stuff. I've worn gold cowboy boots and done a line dance out of a funeral. Because it mattered to that person, and their family felt it was the right thing. Great. You know, and then sometimes I'll tell people these things and they'll go, oh, no, we don't want you in fancy dress. And I'm like, that's fine. I'm not going to rock up in fancy dress if that's not what's right for your mum and you guys. You know, these were two very specific occasions where they wanted Elvis. So I did it. So, you know, yeah. It's like it's your service. It's and I never take away from the real gravity of the situation, that it is a ceremony and ritual, that as human beings, we rely on ceremonies and rituals. It's why we have birthday cakes every year, isn't it? It's like we rely on these things to help us mark the pivotal moments in life. And so it is important that there is a ceremonial and a ritualistic aspect to this event. But dressing as Elvis doesn't take away from that. It's like, you know, I've always said, I'm not going to just come and do stand-up comedy. I'd be awful at it anyway. But there has to be, it has to do the things it's meant to do. I always talk about the fact that the person has died in a funeral. I've been to many funerals where that's never been mentioned. And it just could be, this is your life, but it doesn't talk about that they're dead. I always do a bit about the fact that they're dead. I always do a bit about how do we move on from today with them not being in our lives. Because if we don't do that, then the funeral ritual hasn't done what we as the living need it to do in us. So, yeah. Anyway, that was a waffle. Sorry.
Yeah.
I went off on
one. No, I love it. No, absolutely love it. No, because one of the main things, what I love about that is that one of the main things that got me thinking about being a doula was years ago, I've talked about this a lot, but I lost a friend. He was quite young. I think he was like early 30s, and it was a very aggressive cancer, but he had enough time to sort of put together his wishes. And his wish was that everybody come to his funeral dressed in fancy dress, as something that was like an inside joke between you and him. Brilliant. And it was the most ridiculous, beautiful, personal, wonderful funeral. And it was the first time that I went, oh, this is perfect. Like this is so him. And it just, yeah, I just have these visuals of like people crying in full fancy dress. Like I was dressed up like a cowboy because I'm American, you know, cowboy. People dressed up in like as the Beatles, as just, it was ridiculous, but perfect. And that's what, you know, opened my eyes to, okay, it doesn't always have to be a minister or a priest saying the name wrong and not even knowing who this human being was.
I encourage everyone to know that you don't have to use a minister, you don't have to use a celebrant, you don't have to use a funeral director. You can do this all yourself. These people are here to help you. If a family wanted to do a service themselves but just wanted some support, then I'll do that. You know, you don't have to have me as the person who is telling you everything that has to happen and leading it all from the front. If you need that, yes, I'll do it. But if you just need a bit of encouragement, or if you even just need me to say, you don't need me for this, you've got it, go on, go do it, then I'll do that, you know. This whole idea that, going back to what you said earlier about spending time with the body when someone's died, this idea that when someone dies, it's an emergency and we immediately need to ring a doctor and then we immediately need to ring a funeral director to take them away. It's like, no, we don't. If it's a normal, natural, expected death and it's happened at home, you don't need to ring anyone. You might want to ring the district nurse team or the palliative care team or whoever's been looking after you just to let them know. And they will pop in and they will come and verify the death. But you can keep your person. They don't have to go anywhere. They never have to go anywhere, you know, in that first time period. And there are things available to help look after a body at home. And a really good funeral director will help you with that. Some of them, it might be a shock. But to be able to just kind of talk about, I want to care for my person at home, maybe even just for the first couple of days, and then I want them to go into the care of a funeral director. But maybe I want to keep them at home for a week and then have a burial or whatever. These things can happen. They always did happen, you know? And it's like, and depending on the climate and the time of year, yes, we need to think about how we're going to care for that body and different things that are going to be happening in the body. But again, just to remember, it's a process. So a bit of a pivot. But last year, so just over 18 months ago, my dog died. And like I say, I don't have children. So Ronnie was the closest living thing. He was the only living being that was mine before he was anybody else's. We had a very, very close relationship. And I knew that I wanted Ronnie to die at home. And I wanted to keep him at home for a bit. So I had him at home for 2 weeks on end of life care. And basically I just got to call the vet when it was time. I threw him a living funeral. We called it Ronnie's Grand Farewell. And everyone came and saw him in the garden and gave him a bit of steak and told them how much they loved him. And then on the day, the vet came and, you know, she gave him the lethal injection in my arms. And I'm not stupid. I know what's going to happen. So I had him wrapped in a blanket, but I put a puppy pad around his bottom first because bodies leak. You know, these things happen when someone dies, and with a small animal, it's going to happen. You know, he wasn't a big dog. That's my Ronnie there on the, And I kept him at home, and I had him beside me in bed that night. And I actually live with my parents, and I had him beside me in bed until about 3 o'clock in the morning when my mum came in and said, Emery's starting to smell. And it was August, and it was, you know, it was a warm day, and he was a small being. So I took him out into the garden at that point. But just that is something that can be done. You know, if you can go, actually, I want to experience being with something as it dies and being with a dead body. Well, then if you've got a pet, you can do that as a gentle introduction to how this stuff works and to see what happens. And then, you know, if you've got services around you who are going to support you and help you, or people, you know, then that's great. So my vet was brilliant. We've got another dog as well. And I've been back in, and, you know, and she just talks about how wonderful it was that she knew I kept him at home for a night and stuff. And then actually he's gone to be with someone who's a bone artist, and I'm getting his bones back. So that's what I'm, so yeah, they're not quite ready. So essentially it's part of this whole, it's okay to decay. And part of my death education work, that I'll have Ronnie's bones and I'll go, this is the normal, natural process of what happens after someone dies. And yes, his has been sped up ever so slightly, but it's, you know, it's all been done in a very, very natural way. And it's different. And I know it's not for everybody. But again, talking about that, people go, I didn't know I could do that. If I'd known, I would have done that with my dog or my cat or whatever. And I'm like, I didn't know. I just knew I wanted it. And then I found someone. but wow. Yeah, it's, you know, and I get you. It is a bit weird. But it's right for me.
Yeah, no, see, it's so funny. I'm actually coming up to a year anniversary. So I lost my soul cat a year ago. So I resonate a lot with what you just said. Yeah. And I was very deliberate about the experience with her because it was my partner's first experience of losing a pet. So I wanted to make sure that it was as thoughtful as it could be. So yeah, I doula'd the hell out of all of that. But my previous experiences of having to put a cat down were not good. And, you know, it just, I was aware of what I was able to do. And it was wonderful in that respect. But I had not come across the idea of being able to like keep the bones until honestly it was maybe like 9 months ago or something. And I'm still not sure that I would want to personally, but yeah. I love that it's an option. I've even seen people like doing the pelts so you can keep the pelt.
Yeah. Yeah.
The fur. Like I kept Whiskers. I've got, you know, her ashes in a little urn around my neck. So yeah, it's whatever works for you, but it's understanding what the options are before you get to that point and you're
that's it.
Working out of some like, you know, addled space. But yeah.
Yeah.
How cool. No, I completely agree with you. And I think most people's first experience with death, and it is a different kind of death than with a human, because it's such a pure relationship, it's such a dependent relationship, your whole life sort of revolves around caring for them. But I've always kind of wondered if parents consciously or not, you know, use pets as a way to teach about death, and if that's something that we could move closer towards in terms of like absolutely. Creating death literacy, not just a goldfish, but you know, something bigger.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And I think that goes back to, you know, your rural upbringing and everyone being on a farm and everyone, you know, and animals and stuff like that. So I've got friends who are, who live on a farm and, you know, and they see that natural process of birth and that natural process of death and everything in between. For those of us who live in more urban environments and, you know, haven't got a herd of cattle or a flock of sheep just there. But we all, you know, we tend to have pets and, you know, or someone in the family or a neighbour will have an animal that they care for. And, you know, and it can be. So again, for so many kids, it's their first experience of a bereavement and a loss. So how we tend that, how we prepare them for the death, which we can't always do. We don't always see it. So I knew Ronnie was unwell and I knew, you know, and I had him at the vets and we worked out that what we were going to do and I was going to have time with him. Sometimes we don't, you know, animals are amazing creatures, but they can hide things and it might just be an instant decision. This animal now needs to be put to sleep or whatever. But having those conversations, particularly as pets get older, we can start talking about, you know, what will happen next at some point. And talking about what would make it right for the child. Like, how can the child be involved in a way? Again, the idea of drawing pictures and sending letters with a coffin. What would be right for the child? You know, and is your small animal, if it's small enough, is it going to be buried in your garden? Or are you going to have it cremated? Or is it just going to be flushed down the toilet if it's a goldfish or, you know, but or whatever, what's right for the child and how can you create some kind of gentle ritual in that? And there's oodles of resources on the internet. The internet's got everything, you know, just have a look or reach out to your local doula. We will all give you some guidance on how to do something or how to, what to start to think about when creating a ritual that is right for you and your dying thing. you know, person, animal, whatever. You know, that's, you know, we love talking about this stuff. Ask us.
If you had a magic wand that could just change something about our culture, whether it's, you know, Western or just UK or whatever, in terms of our relationships with death and dying or even ritual or whatever, you have a magic wand and you've just waved it. What has just changed?
Everyone dies at home and everyone sees that dead body. With whatever interventions are needed, but everyone sees that person's body and it become, just to go back in time, take us back in time. I love that we've got the healthcare system we've got, but it's making us live too long often and in undignified ways. And it sees death as failure. So yeah, I would go back to where death is not failure. It's normal and natural. And everyone sees the dead body at home. So
easy.
A lot of people are like that. Yeah. You know, that's, yeah, most people will go, I don't want to do that. I don't want to see that. And I'm like, It's because you haven't seen it.
Yeah. I mean, you don't really have to go back all that far for that to have been the norm. I mean, it's only a few generations. So that wand isn't working too hard, really.
No, it's not. Yeah.
Wonderful. Okay. Thank you so much. It was absolutely wonderful to speak to you. Please let me know what's going on with all of your other projects. I love the idea of going into a primary school and just showing that. So when that happens, if that happens, please let me know.
Absolutely.
But yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Baby, you know, I just like to talk with you. I just wanna go out.